So what I want to do is take you through a journey of ideas, thinking that I've been going through myself around the whole issue of non-duality, the essence of the cosmos. And this is just my sort of current thinking. If I'm here in a couple of years' time, I'll probably say it very differently. So don't take this as absolute truth. It's not. It's just sharing with you sort of some of my thinking that's exciting me at the moment. Now, the first thing is science is already non-dual. When people think, you know, science needs to recognize non-duality, science is already non-dual in a respect. It's a materialistic non-duality. And when I say science, what I'm really talking about is a scientific worldview. So science, as I'm using it, is shorthand for the scientific worldview. And that current scientific worldview says that ultimately the essence of the cosmos is physical in nature, not really material, but physical, space, time, matter, energy, although even that's beginning to dissolve. But there's something physical there, and they're looking for that physical essence. They're looking for the unified field theory, the mathematics that brings it all together. So they're looking for that non-duality, that unity, the unified field, sometimes called the theory of everything. So it's already non-dual. It's just, it has a very different view of non-duality from the spiritual traditions, which say that everything is ultimately mind, consciousness, spirit, whatever you want to call it. But I think, and this is what I want to show today, I think that science is actually unwittingly, it doesn't realize this, moving towards the non-dual position that many of the mystics and great sages have pointed out for thousands of years. But it doesn't know it at the moment. If you told scientists they were pointing in that direction, they wouldn't want to hear it, because they're at the moment firmly rooted in this materialistic paradigm. But there's several problems with materialistic paradigm. One is that there doesn't seem to be any matter there. You know, we know this when you start looking down into, you know, what is this composed of? The idea used to be, sort of the old Greek idea, there were atoms, were hard lumps of solid matter. And then about 100 years ago, we realized that wasn't the case. They were composed of subatomic particles. And then we started looking at subatomic particles and realized they didn't really exist. They were just probabilities of making an observation. You know, they were just eigenvalues in a matrix, which is just a mathematical concept. And it's almost like science has been going through its own neti-neti from the Upanishads, meaning not this, not that. Every time we think we understand what the universe is, we start exploring it, it dissolves. It's like, oh no, it wasn't that. And we start looking deeper. Well, maybe it's this. No, it wasn't that. It's like the material universe, as we look into it, just keeps on dissolving. We can't really grasp it. But then there's also an even bigger problem with the materialistic view, and that is consciousness itself. The very fact that we are all experiencing beings. And this is, to my mind, the real anomaly for the scientific paradigm, the materialistic paradigm, the current worldview. An anomaly is an inexplicable observation, something that cannot be accounted for. And we often think, you know, anomalies with the paradigm are things like ESP or healing, which certainly are anomalies. They're things that cannot be explained, but also they're not fully accepted at the moment. I mean, a number of scientists accept their occurrence, but also there's many people who just say, well, the evidence isn't fully in yet. Well, there's been thousands of papers published, but the evidence isn't fully in, so we don't have to accept it. But we do have to accept our consciousness. It's the one thing we cannot deny. The only thing we absolutely know for sure is that we are experiencing beings. We are having experience right now. And we could even doubt this experience. I mean, for all you know, you might be plugged into the matrix right now. Your body might be in some nice nutrient bath somewhere, and you'll be fed by this computer into this wonderful simulated reality of being at a science and non-duality conference in somewhere on planet Earth. We can doubt the experience, but you'd still be an experiencing being. The one thing we cannot doubt is that we are experiencing. So it's absolutely undeniable. And it's inexplicable. There is nothing in science, in the scientific worldview, that predicts that any of us should ever have an experience. And yet any scientific theory, its test is its predictability. You come up with a new theory, and you say, okay, what does this predict? And you see if its predictions come true. But the current scientific worldview doesn't predict that any of us should ever have an internal experience. We should all just be biological robots without this inner awareness. So in a strange way, science occurs in the mind. Science, all of science, the thinking, the observations, the theories, it's all in the mind. The mind is the tool of science, and yet it's the one thing science hasn't really looked at and can't really explain. I often think scientists would be much happier if there were no such thing as consciousness. But then, you know, they wouldn't know whether they were happy or not. That's the problem. The current view amongst the majority of the scientific worldview is that consciousness somehow is created by the brain. Now, certainly there's a very strong correlation between what goes on in the brain and what appears in our experience. And I'd go so far as to say, you know, there might even be 100% correlation, that everything we experience has a corresponding activity state in the brain. And you change the brain subtly, you may change the experience. So I'm happy to accept a one-to-one correlation there between the brain and experience. But the other question, which is often confused, people don't separate the two questions, is although the brain may determine what goes on in consciousness, does the brain generate consciousness? Does it actually generate experience? That generate awareness? And this is what Stuart referred to yesterday as the hard problem. David Chalmers called it the hard problem. He was saying, the easy problem is understanding the brain. Even if we completely understand the brain, and we may do in years to come, we may understand exactly what goes on when I solve a mathematical problem or fall in love or something else. We may understand all that goes on in the brain. The hard problem is, why does any of that give rise to an experience? Why does it all just go on in the dark? As David Chalmers put it, how does something as unconscious as matter ever give rise to something as immaterial as experience? They're just two totally different things. And part of the problem here is that we're rooted in the assumption that consciousness has to somehow come out of matter. Whether it's in the brain or something else, where it's in the microtubules, but something's going on in the world of matter that leads to the emergence of consciousness. That consciousness somehow comes out of it. And the fact that we can't get anywhere with this, the fact that this is just this huge, hard problem, suggests to me that there's actually something wrong with the paradigm. The worldview. And we seem to be, I think, in the stage that Thomas Kuhn pointed out. Thomas Kuhn was the person who coined the word paradigm about 40 years ago in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he pointed out that science doesn't change smoothly, but people hold on to their ideas. That we hold on to our ideas and beliefs more strongly than we hold on to just about anything else. And we won't change our religion, we won't change our religious beliefs, or very hard. We don't change our scientific beliefs. We'll change profession, change career, change partners, change where we live, we change about everything else, but we hold on to our beliefs. Max Planck said, before Cooney said, science doesn't proceed in graceful steps. It proceeds because the old scientists die out and new ones take their place. Or someone paraphrased him once saying, science proceeds funeral by funeral. So what Kuhn showed was what the way a paradigm shift happens. We all talk about paradigm shifts. The way a paradigm shift happens is that, first of all, there's an anomaly. There's something that can't be explained. And initially it's ignored. And then when it can't be ignored any longer, people try to explain it within the existing model. And the classic case of that, which we're all familiar with, is what happened with the old geocentric view of the universe, where the Earth was the center, with all the stars going round, planets, sun, moon, all going round the Earth. The anomaly, the thing that didn't fit then, was the movement of the planets, because they moved around, they didn't move in smooth circles. Plato predicted everything in the heavens would move in smooth circles because heaven was perfect and circular motion was perfect. And the planets didn't. They wandered backwards and forwards. In fact, the word planeta in Greek means to wander. They were the wandering stars. They sometimes went backwards, moved this way. But they were stuck. The early astronomers were stuck in the belief that the Earth was the center and things were going round in circles. And so they invented all these things called epicycles, which are sort of circles rolling around circles. And if you do that, you can get things moving different ways. And when that didn't quite fit, they invented more complex circles, then more complex circles. And by about the 15th century, they had these really intricate models of all these different circles and spheres, everything rolling around each other, trying to imitate the motion of the planets. And Copernicus came along and said two things. One, he said the Earth is spinning, which everybody thought was stupid, because if the Earth is spinning, all the oceans would slop up on one side. And secondly, that the Earth was just actually spinning around the sun, which was anathema, and he didn't even dare publish his work until just before he died. And 50 years later, when Galileo found evidence for this telescope, the bishops refused to look down the telescope because they knew it couldn't be true. And it was only another 50 years after that, that Newton came along and did the mathematics and proved he was right. But that's how a paradigm shift happens. There's the anomaly, and people try to integrate it into the old model, until finally someone comes along and questions the fundamental assumption. And I think the same thing is happening with consciousness in the current times. As I say, it's an anomaly for the whole scientific worldview, the very existence of experience. And the stage at which I think we're at the moment is very similar to the early astronomers creating the epicycles. We are epicycling it. It's a verb I created. To epicycle means to try and fit things back in. You know, it must come somehow out of the brain. We're so rooted in this idea that consciousness is generated by the brain. We keep on thinking, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, maybe it's this. But everything that comes up, every theory that's put up, still comes against this fundamental problem of why should unconscious matter ever give rise to experience. And no one actually questions, well, very few people question, have been questioning the fundamental assumption that matter is insentient. But there are a growing number of people beginning to challenge this. And this, I think, is the seed of a new worldview which is slowly coming into being. And this alternative worldview says that experience goes all the way down. Well, sometimes everything is conscious. But when we talk of consciousness, just take a little deviation here, I think we mislead ourselves by making consciousness a noun. Ajahn Shanti pointed towards this. You know, whenever we add ness onto a word, like holiness, anything else, when we add ness onto a word, humbleness, we're taking an adjective and making a noun out of it so that we can talk about it. But if when we talk about consciousness as a thing, I think we're off on the wrong track. Because consciousness, we are conscious of things. Consciousness isn't a thing we are conscious of. So it's being conscious, which is the anomaly, the fact that we are conscious. And so the new worldview that's coming in saying that being conscious, having experience, is something that goes all the way down through creation. There's nowhere you can draw a line. On the current model, the idea is there must be a line somewhere. You know, human beings are conscious. We accept that animals are conscious. And if we didn't accept they were conscious, why would we give them anesthetics when we operated? Why would we want to make them unconscious? We accept animals are conscious. You know, I would imagine a spider would feel pain if I pulled its legs off. It would have feelings. Where do we draw the line? Some people say, well, maybe, you know, with maybe neurons are the thing. A creature that doesn't have neurons isn't conscious. I think it's just less aware. I don't think there's anywhere you can draw the line. This doesn't mean to say that, you know, a bacterium has thoughts or feelings. Its consciousness would just be the vaguest, vaguest glimmer of what we know. You know, like, if you could put numbers on it, it might be a billionth of what we know as consciousness. You know, almost completely dark, but not nothing. There's not a complete absence of interiority. Ken Wilber calls it proto-consciousness, is that potential for experience. It's always there. And philosophically, this is what's called panpsychism, the idea that all, pan all, psyche is mind. Mind is in all things. And conversely, all things are in the mind. Everything we know, everything we experience is known in the mind. And by mind, I mean that continually unfolding sequence of experiences. And again, Ajahn Shanti pointed out, we don't know the world out there directly. And many philosophers have pointed this out. I mean, right now, you are experiencing, you're all experiencing this room in various ways. And we know what is happening is that in terms of vision, light is coming in through the eyes, being processed, sent to the back of the brain where the signals are analyzed. And very quickly and cleverly, in about a tenth of a second, the brain puts together its picture of what is out there in 3D, full color, detailed representation of what is out there. And it integrates it with sound, full stereo, it's touchy-feely, and it's got internal emotions, thoughts with it. We get this whole reality appearing in our experience. And it is so good, most of the time, it is so convincing that we think we're actually experiencing the world directly. But all we're actually experiencing is our own virtual reality created by our senses, observing the world. So we live in a representation of the reality out there. But most of the time we forget that because it's so good and it works, we interact with it, until things like visual illusions come along where we realize it's not quite what it seems. That's why psychologists are so fascinated by visual illusions, because they show errors in the way the brain is constructing its experience of what's out there. Now, we might think that what is out there is just like our experience of it. But it actually turns out to be nothing whatsoever like it. I mean, take colour, for example. I mean, here's, you know, a red chair. You can see red in front of you, the back of the chair in front of you. There's no red out there. There's coloured light, what we call coloured light, but it's actually light of a different frequency. It doesn't actually have the colour. It's light of a certain energy, we could say, or a certain frequency, a certain wavelength. But it's not actually red. When it hits the retina, it's just the chemical impulses, the electrochemical impulses aren't red. They're just electrochemical impulses going down certain nerve fibers, which when they get to the back of the brain are translated as, oh, this refers to that color. The redness only appears in the mind. And this is true of everything you see. It's true of sound. I mean, as you're listening to my voice now, all there is out there is moving air molecules, moving backwards and forwards very fast, which hit the eardrum, and your brain interprets them and creates the experience of sound. Or smell, you know, you smell a flower, the molecules stimulate the nose and the brain again creates the experience of smell. So all that we know of the world is actually created in the mind, and the actual world out there turns out to be very different in almost every single respect. I was saying earlier, there's no matter out there. Although this seems very real, when we look into it, there's no matter out there. The physicist Hans-Peter Dürer put it very nicely. He said, whatever matter is, it's not made of matter. We just don't know what's out there. And so what's actually going on is we have the experience and then we imagine the world out there is like our experience. That's where we get tripped up. And this is one understanding of the Indian concept of Maya, often translated as illusion. I prefer to think of it as delusion. We delude ourselves when we think that the world out there is like our experience. But it isn't. It's something very, very different. And perhaps all we can really say of the world is the mathematical description. And that's what modern physics is doing, is trying to get the mathematical description of it. Then what we do is, on top of the maths, we apply models like particles or waves and things like that to try and understand the maths. But I think the absolute nature of reality is probably a purely mathematical description. And that's something I think all beings would agree upon. They may disagree upon how to interpret the mathematics, but I think if we ever made contact with ETs, who probably live in a very different world, if we understood their mathematics, we'd probably agree with it. Their formulation of what it's all about might be very different, but ultimately I think the math is the underlying reality. But the question is what is the math actually describing? And the first assumption is that, as I said earlier, this is describing something which may not be matter, but is something that is inherently physical in nature, in some form. It's like it's the essence of physicality. The math is describing the essence of physicality, whatever that essence is. We know space and time are relative. We know matter and energy are relative. But there's this assumption, there's something down there, deep down, which is essentially physical. And then the other bit which I've been bringing to that is to say, and whatever that is, there is that potential for experience. If the potential for experience goes all the way down, if there's no way you can draw a line, then that potential, that proto-consciousness, whatever you want to call it, is there in the essence. And that led me to an obviously dualistic model, which I wasn't happy with. Because it's saying that there is, you know, the essence of the universe is both experiencing and it's physical. And it's, so I sort of tussled with this and looked at various ways, you know, to sort of go beyond that inherent dualism. And then it was one day I was sitting with Adyashanti. He was giving a weekend at Spirit Rock, and I was sitting there. I was going to say I was listening to him. I wasn't actually listening to him. my mind was wandering off. And it wasn't anything he said, but it maybe just had been because he was, you know, talking about non-duality. Something unconscious just suddenly clicked. And it was like that moment of awakening. And I suddenly thought, well, what happens if we let go of the assumption that there's any physicality at all? What I saw was like, every time we try to grasp it, it disappears. There appears to be no thing there. What if that is actually true? There's actually nothing there. Nothing. No thing. Thingness is purely a construction in the mind. The mind observes things in its experience. And we imagine there's thingness out there, but supposing there's no thing out there. And it just instantly flashed that you immediately move into a non-dual model in which there is just, and we haven't got the language for this, I haven't found the language, but there is an experiencing field, very highly structured experiencing field, which experiencing itself creates the appearance of the material world. So what we know of as the material world is the appearance for us in our mind of our consciousness experiencing the infinite field of consciousness out there and interpreting that as a material world, as a physical world. And this isn't just a non-duality in terms of saying everything is ultimately consciousness. It's both saying the internal, everything we know, is an experience arising in consciousness, and what we call, quote, the external, is just a field of consciousness experiencing itself. Ultimately, that duality of inner and outer also dissolves. And we could call that, I'd say we don't have the words for it, but we could call it, you know, the a field of being, of spirit, consciousness, or experiencing, or Brahman. Probably the best word for it is Brahman, from Sanskrit in the Upanishads and other Indian teachings. Brahman is the source of everything that is. It is the source. And Brahman has that quality of awareness. It isn't a physical essence, it's an awareness essence. So on that model, consciousness isn't something that has suddenly evolved at a certain stage of evolution. It's always there. It is the essence of the cosmos. What's evolved has been the structure, if you like, of the cosmos, of that field, plus the representations that have evolved in the experiencing mind. So as creatures have evolved with senses, with nervous systems, eventually to human beings, we have this incredibly rich experience of the world. That's what's evolved. Consciousness was always there. The experience is what's evolved. And human beings have reached the point where we are self-aware. We have self-reflective consciousness. We are aware that we are aware, which is both a wonderful bonus and a trap. Because as soon as we are aware that we are aware, the question becomes, well, who is aware? And that's something which several people have explored. And we fall into the trap of thinking, well, there must be an I. There's something there called I. And again, we construct a thing. There's a construction that happens in the mind. And we start telling ourselves a story. As long as we're just experiencing raw experience, as Rupert pointed out last night, there's just that, there's no I, there's just the experiencing happening. But as soon as we start reflecting upon it, as soon as self-reflective consciousness comes in and we start reflecting upon our experience, we start telling ourselves a story, and in that story we tell ourselves, there's this sense of I. And it's a very real character in that story. I sometimes think it's a bit like you're reading a novel, and in the novel there's a character, perhaps the hero, and that character is very real in the novel. But outside the novel, it's just a character in the novel. We create this story for ourselves in our mind about there being an I that is experiencing. And within that story, and a lot of us live within that story a lot of the time, then the I is very, very real in that story. Only when you step out the story that it disappears. That wonderful quote that Ravi gave last night of the I stepping outside itself and then there's just the I that's left. I can't do it justice, but most of you heard it. And the spiritual quest is to see through that. And it's framed in different ways, that exploration of what is the self, what is experiencing, what is aware, that quest. And there was something. I just want to point out, yes, this is from Schrödinger. This is a physicist who was on this quest. Schrödinger's equation, Schrödinger's cat, great physicist of the last century. He was fascinated by this question of what is the I? And he said, you will on close introspection, notice his introspection is looking within yourself. You will on close introspection find that what you really mean by I is the ground stuff upon which all experiences and memories are collected. And as we look into that self, that's where we begin to meet the spiritual. I think it's that question which is the door to the spiritual. Thomas Merton says, if I penetrate to the depths of my own existence, to the indefinable am that is myself in its deepest roots, then through this deep center, I pass into the infinite I am, which is the very name of the Almighty. Ramana Maharshi said, I am is the name of God. Or I sometimes like to turn that round and say, God is the name we give to that experience of pure being, pure amness. We give that the name of God. Or in Indian thought, Atman is Brahman. Atman is that pure essence of amness, that pure first-person experience of being that's always there, is Brahman, is the source of everything. Which if you translate it into English, you come up with things like, I am God, which is a very dangerous thing to say. You used to get burnt at the stake for it, now you just get put into mental hospitals and given drugs till you recant. But when you realize they're not saying that I, Peter Russell or whoever, is the guy who created the universe or the woman or whatever, but saying that that essence of I-ness, when we connect with that essence of I-ness, that beingness beyond the constructions in the mind, we are connecting with the essence of the cosmos. And if the essence of the cosmos is experiencing, a field of experience, then when we connect with our own essential nature as experiencing being, we are connecting with the essence of the whole cosmos. And as the Upanishads say, those who know that know the supreme and can talk of nothing else. Thanks.